Welcome everyone to another edition of the NatCon Australia podcast. Today I'm delighted to welcome Andrew Hale, who is a senior policy analyst in trade policy at the Heritage Foundation, Washington DC. He previously worked for the British and American governments in foreign policy and trade issues. Welcome, Andrew.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
So everyone is obviously quite interested in what will happen when Trump formally takes office after January 20. The key often used phrase is personnel is policy. Who will be the key people in the trade in the Trump administration deciding and framing trade issues?
Well, Howard Lutnick, of course, has been nominated to become the President Trump's Commerce Secretary. And on CNBC, Howard Lutnick explained away actually some of President Trump's call for across-the-board tariffs when he was actually on CNBC a couple months ago. And when asked about across-the-board tariffs, like the 10 or 20%, he said that that was a broad statement during the election made by the president so people could understand a very complex issue. And then started talking about targeted use of tariffs. And of course, as we know, Howard Lutnick has been not just nominated for Commerce Secretary, but also unusually given specific authority over tariffs, as they say. One can expect that we'll have a targeted use of tariffs as we did in President Trump's first term, but this has implications for the other people appointed. And of course, for example, Jameson Greer, who was chief of staff under Ambassador Lighthizer at the United States Trade Representative. That office would normally be the one that would have tariff authority, but that, as they've announced, that authority is going to be transferred to the Department of Commerce under Howard Lutnick. And then, of course, we have other people who've been appointed, such as Scott Bessent has been appointed at the Treasury. He's, of course, a Wall Street man. And then, of course, we have, he used to work for George Soros. These are not traditional protectionists. They're largely free market, free trade people. And then, of course, we've got Hassett at the National Economic Council. So again, someone who is very keen working on tax policy and economics in President Trump's first term. Unusually, we were expecting to see Ambassador Robert Lighthizer, of course, wrote this book, No Trade is Free.
Good book.
It's when was the last time a trade policy book was actually a popular book? And of course, right there in the subtitle, it says Changing Course, Taking on China. So that was what I was expecting to be the playbook for the next Trump administration. I understand he's still very close to the president advising him, but it does give an indication that President Trump very much wants to be his own man and take a free hand on trade policy.
Right. So we still don't have a U.S. trade representative. It was assumed that Robert Lighthizer would take up the position
It was given to Jameson Greer.
Oh, it has been given to Jameson Greer. Okay,
so Jameson Greer has been given. Now, Jameson Greer was chief of staff to Ambassador Lighthizer, but he's quite young by comparison. For example, Ambassador Lighthizer really is someone who's quite formidable. He is someone who's been around in Washington in senior positions through various administrations for decades. And that's really, I think, put the Office of U.S. Trade Representative, as we call it, USTR, in a central position, a predominant position. Wilbur Ross, who was the Commerce Secretary under President Trump, was quite elderly, and he was not as formidable, shall we say, as Ambassador Lighthizer. So the dynamics are different now. Now you've got Lutnick, Howard Lutnick, as the Commerce Secretary. And you have someone who's quite young and not as seasoned as Ambassador Lighthizer running the Office of U.S. Trade Representative as the USTR. And so it looks like the dynamics have somewhat switched there. So you'll see, as they've already announced, that it's the Commerce Department who will have the authority over tariff policy, which, of course, will be key. And I think
Do we understand why Robert Lighthizer hasn't? Didn't retake that role? What have you heard?
I really wouldn't want to second guess. Like I said, he may have been offered something. I have no idea. He may have been offered something. He may have been offered something that, that he didn't want, or perhaps he didn't want to go back to USTR again. I have no idea. There, like I said, and there's still many positions that are available that he could go into. Perhaps he wants to do something beyond trade policy. I mean, he's done so many positions, high-level positions in successive administrations, Republican presidential administrations. It's likely he could do something else and perhaps would want to do the same thing again. But I really have to say that I'm not privy to that.
No problem. It probably is worth just describing in the broad the tariff proposals that Trump has made as currently understood. Can you do a run of the boards on that, please?
So, for example, yes, I think it's important to define the term. So the president discovered, President Trump discovered in his first term that he had, that the president of the United States has exclusive authority over 301, 201, and 232 tariffs. So, to very simply, that's because these are quite complex tariffs. 301 involves unfair practices, which, of course, China is notorious for that. And then, of course, you have 201, which would be about threats to the U.S. economy, a large influx of goods that could be a threat to the U.S. economy, for example. And then 232, which, of course, are national security threats. So that's very simply. Those are the tariffs. I could go on explaining, but there, that's very simply for your viewers what they are. And those are the three tariffs that the president has exclusive authority over without checks from Congress. He doesn't have to worry about Congress checking those. So he learned in his first term that he could have these tools in his arsenal and weaponize them, and not just weaponize them in trade policy, but in other areas. So, for example, as we've seen recently, The president, it was over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend. President Trump, released a series of statements outlining two major policy proposals aimed at addressing pressing national security issues, which weren't trade related necessarily. The first proposal, of course, related to Canada and Mexico's responsibility for the illegal immigration. And of course, then the second one he announced was the one about the BRICS country and the threats to de-dollarization. Now that's a threat to use a 25% tariff on Canada and Mexico, and another one, which I think was 100% tariff. And that's using 301, 201, and 232 tariffs, the tariffs he has exclusive control over in those areas which are foreign policy related and national security related. So he's willing to use these in areas that are not necessarily trade policy related, and he's entirely entitled to do so.
Yeah, so the president has these powers to impose, use executive authority to impose these tariffs for, broadly speaking, national security reasons or those that harm the economic interests of the United States for a period of time. And he's used them in the past, and he'll rely on those in the future to do it again. As I understand the tariff policies, he set a 60% tariff on China, which builds on existing tariffs that were imposed during his first term and maintained under the Biden administration. Then there's this 10 to 20% universal global tariff on all good products. I'm not sure whether it's agriculture or manufactured goods, but that's significant for someone like Australia. And then there's selected, he's made these additional threats of 200% on electric vehicles or 200% on John Deere tractors if they move them to Mexico. And then you're like you said, there's these additional tariffs for non-economic reasons, targeting, you know, fentanyl or threats to, you know, not do enough action in relation to the migrant that are coming to the United States. I also then noticed there's another one proposal which hasn't probably got enough press, is that he's proposed to impose tariffs not only on goods originating from China, but also on goods produced outside China by Chinese-owned companies. Is that, have I summarized it correctly?
You've taken on a number of them, of those, and actually, but I want to address the cross-the-board tariffs, if I may.
Yeah.
And actually, like I said, let's just look at what Howard Lutnick said. As I previously said, he went on CNBC News and explained away President Trump's call for across-the-board tariffs during the elections. And he said that that statement was made so people could understand this complex issue. So and then he immediately started talking about targeted use of tariffs, which, of course, is what President Trump had used in his first term. And then, of course, you know, I think let's just talk about the difficulties of across the board tariff. No president really has that authority. I have heard during the campaign there was threats to use emergency powers, but there's also the issue with that, that those would be challenged to the federal courts because what's the emergency? There's also the Administrative Procedures Act. And that's important because the Administrative Procedures Act dictates that the executive should not behave in an arbitrary or capricious manner. And you could argue that an across-the-board tariff on every product and every service coming to the United States from every country is arbitrary and capricious. Let's just look at, so that's the legal aspect of the difficulties of that. And he didn't have across-the-board tariff in his first term. Then, of course, you have to look at the feasibility. So if you look at it in President Trump's first term, just under the 301 tariffs that he weaponized against China on steel and aluminium, that took a great deal of time by lawyers, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, to come up with a legal case so it wouldn't be so there wouldn't be litigation against it. And just, it's just not feasible that there could be a tariff, a 301 tariff, or a 201 or a 232 tariff against every product and every service coming from every country into the United States. Now, we did actually have a 20% across-the-board tariff. And for your viewers, there's a really good small book on this by Professor Douglas Irwin from Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. And it's called Peddling Protectionism. Okay. And that is about the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of 1930. Now, that was a 20% tariff that was passed by, it was introduced by Congressman Hawley and Senator Smoot, both Republicans, in 1930. And that required a 60% vote to get passed in the Senate. Now, you're not going to get that now. Even if you tried to get it through reconciliation, which we mean have to get just over 50 percent, that's, I think, the numbers aren't there. So I think there's some real difficulty and legally and feasibly with regards to an across-the-board tariff. Now, what my colleague Richard Stern and I here at the Heritage Foundation, we've been looking at, for example, a tariff-like tax. I think that's one thing that could be done that's feasible, that could be added into a tax bill, and they have to do the tax bill next year. So you could add in a border adjustment tax. And just to explain, tariffs and international tax policy can also be used to remove imbalances in the global tax system that for decades, in my opinion, have stifled our economy and helped to neuter American industry. So most industrialized world, they tax domestic consumption. And this means that countries tend to tax products consumed domestically, whether produced there or imported, and tend not to tax products made domestically that are then exported abroad. And the American tax system, as it presently is, on the other hand, taxes production and not consumption. And that imbalance means that exported American products face a double layer of taxation, once under U.S. business taxes, and then a second time under foreign consumption taxes. And this is a double tax layer that hinders U.S. industrial development and puts our workers at a disadvantage. It also means that imports to the United States tend not to face much taxation. And in effect, our tax system favors foreign production over American production, and then double taxes our exported products. And so it's not America first. It's actually what I would call America last for workers and business owners alike. And so what we're suggesting is a border adjustment tax, a tariff-like tax, and this is what's feasible, and you can get that through a tax bill. It's known in federal policy circles, as I said, as a border adjustment tax, and that could help solve this problem. This program would subject all imports to a uniform tax and exempt all U.S. exports from taxation. Now, in Australia, you have a value-added tax, a VAT, as I understand it, at the federal level. We do not have that in the United States. Europe has it, the UK, United Kingdom has it. We don't have that. And we don't have it at the federal level here. Yes, there are state taxes, but we do not have this at the federal level of the United States. So this would actually, I think, really update the tax system. It's a tariff-like tax. And this solution could correct this imbalance and end this decades-long imposed penalty on U.S. domestic production. And there's other benefits. It would also raise significant federal revenue. A 10% adjustment, for example, would take in roughly $1 trillion over 10 years. And that's really important because these new revenues would be enough to powerfully cut other taxes, allowing, for example, full and immediate business tax reductions for research and development work and for investments in physical capital such as factories. And so, in conclusion, that's a roadmap for careful and productive tariff policy. And then one that could be used as a tool to negotiate even-handed trade deals to remove current penalties on domestic production and, for example, to gain revenues that can be applied to pro-growth tax cuts. So that's what we call here at the Heritage Foundation, mastering the art of the tariff policy with a sort of tariff-like border adjustment tax to be one of the strongest tools in the next president's disposal to bolster our economy, as well as unleash American industry and allow American families to flourish. And you already have a value-added tax in Europe. And this is not, I think, the threatening, 20% or 10% across the board that was very simplistically discussed, understandably, because it was an election campaign. And now the election's over and people are starting to look at these issues more seriously. I mean, Kamala Harris, for example, in the campaign, she suggested price controls. No president has that authority. The New York Times, a left-wing paper, slapped her down over that. So this is something the president could do to, if he wants to do an across-the-board tariff, this is something that's feasible. But some of the other stuff that's been suggested isn't feasible, and there'd be some legal difficulties as well. That's just talking about the across-the-board tariff suggestion.
But right. So let's just focus on that one, because that's probably of most relevance, actually, to Australia, although some of the aluminium tariffs last time around we had to get an exemption for too, but across the board 10-20%. You say the statements from Lutnick, who's the designated commerce secretary, suggests that that's not the intention. This border adjustment tax was actually mooted during the first Trump administration, right, as an alternative to his tariff proposals, but he didn't actually take it up. So I'm just wondering whether he will actually go back and revert to what he campaigned on in his plain speaking way and just implement the across the board tariffs that he think. Do you think it's realistic? You say it's unlikely to be implemented, or doesn't have the political support in Congress, but I don't know. It was a fairly emphatic.
Border adjustment, if I could interrupt, a border adjustment tax could actually come in through a tax bill. Okay, so you just need just over 50% majority. You can get that. The problem is when you're doing, as I explained, the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which was that was at a time when we didn't have free trade agreements with many countries. There were no free trade agreements at the time. It was introduced to end the Great Depression. It actually prolonged it. Every economist of note that I'm aware of states that. It was largely seen as a huge disaster. I think after 96 years, we don't have to make that decision again. And I'm not suggesting that that's what people are talking about. I certainly didn't hear it during the election campaign. I didn't hear President Trump or his people talk about a Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, because it's not a terribly good example. And that is the example of having the Congress pass such a tariff bill of 20%. I think with a border adjustment tax, I think that 5-7% is what is reasonable. I think that I'm saying that's what's possible. They may not, and maybe President Trump doesn't want to do that. What Lutnick said on CNBC, Howard Lutnick said on CNBC, was really focusing on a targeted use of tariffs, which is what President Trump did in his first term. And also, not just tariffs, but also, I wouldn't call President Trump an ideological protectionist or an ideological free trader. He is a deal maker. He likes deals. You should read The Art of the Deal. I'm sure it's very relevant to him as president, even when it was relevant as a businessman. He likes deal making, and he's discovered these 301, 201, and 232 tariffs in his toolbox that he can use as president without checks from other institutions. And so what's happened with that is that he's focused. He honed in on those. Also, if you look at, he was actually negotiating a number of free trade agreements at the time he left office. So, for example, I was very much aware of and part of the UK-US free trade agreement negotiations. Those were in their advanced stages. Sadly, the United Kingdom was not out of the European Union at the time. And then, of course, there was the Kenya free trade agreement that was close to being signed at the time he left office. There was an Ecuador negotiation, a Brazil negotiation. He renegotiated the South Korea, Japan, and of course, the NAFTA into the new USMCA for Canada and Mexico. So there was the free trade alongside protectionism, which was largely directed at unfair practices, and particularly the People's Republic of China. And I think that that's what where he'll be focusing most of his ire on in his second term. That's what Bob Lighthizer's book says right here, Changing Course, Taking on China. So I think that will be, I didn't see a lot of tariff activity against our allies and friends. We have a free trade agreement. The United States has a free trade agreement with Australia and New Zealand. We also have the AUKUS agreement to provide nuclear-powered submarines from the Royal Australian Navy. And the relationship is very, very good. Certainly in the last 4 years, those proposing protectionist trade policies against Australia and New Zealand actually haven't come from the executive, either Biden or President Trump. They came from special interest groups who were trying to push some protectionist policies onto senators and congressmen, and that didn't really, fortunately, they didn't take that up. There wasn't much success there.
Yeah, just to push back a little bit, I mean, you know, Trump has said that tariffs is the most beautiful word in the English language. Mm. And people like Robert Lighthizer, I think would be fair to say, have a much more kind of comprehensive, philosophical and thoughtful approach to using tariffs and trade policy. They think tariffs do work. They can be useful, incorporated, and there's a large sort of spectrum between, you know, trying to not trade with anyone and alleging that it doesn't matter who you're trading with, just as long as you're trading, right? So, you still think that it's unlikely? Correct me if I'm summarizing incorrectly, but you think the 10 to 20% global tariff is unlikely to be implemented, but the tariffs on China and perhaps some of the other ones on selected, you know, companies or products will likely be implemented as a tariff rather than a border adjustment tax or similar.
Yes, I mean, like I said, I'm going by what happened in the first term, also by what's feasible, and I've explained the difficulties of an across-the-board tariff as it was described during the campaign. The feasibility of that at the executive level, as well as the legal issues. And then, of course, that's why my colleague and I, Richard Stern, really honed in on the border adjustment tax, the tariff-like tax, or as others call it, a tariff-like mechanism, because that's a way that you could do that. But I don't see them talking about that right now. I mean, everything I'm hearing from the people that have been appointed, they're talking about using tariffs, not just for tariff policy, for other foreign policy and national security issues, and I think that will definitely increase. And it has happened before, and indeed, as Dr. Laffer, who of course of the Laffer curve, said in a meeting on Thursday, that he's totally entitled to do so as president. I mean, he's aware that these are, when he says a beautiful word, well, he discovered, wow, the president, a lot of people think, you know, the president's all powerful, but there are checks on the president's power. But this is one area with these three forms of tariffs, there are no checks. That's why, for example, in just this session of Congress, Senator Rand Paul wanted a bill to go through to take away those 301, 201, and 232 tariffs. I mean, that didn't go anywhere. And I think that was wrong because no president would sign a bill taking away their powers. I don't even think President Biden would do that unless he wanted to do so as a lame duck president now, knowing that President Trump's coming into office. I can see the only logic for him trying to do that now, signing such a bill. even if it got past this lame duck session of Congress, which is not going to happen, he would only do so to kneecap President Trump, and that would be a very cynical move. But no president wants to give up their powers. But these are those specific tariffs are tariffs he can use. And I think we can see them in used in other ways. He's taking a lot of advice from Elon Musk. And I think Elon Musk was very concerned about the misinformation bill that was going through the Australian Parliament. I understand it was pulled by the Albanese government. It's no longer going to go to the Senate, as I understand. That is something that I think that you could see in trade negotiations becoming an issue, freedom of speech. Already the U.S., the Senate Judiciary Committee has had a session where they examined the UK's online harms bill. And when I talked to, I've been promoting and I've written a lot about, it's the position of the Heritage Foundation that we have a UK-US free trade agreement. But when I speak to congressmen, senators, and their staff in both houses of Congress, the repeated message I'm getting is, we're concerned about having a free trade agreement with a country that doesn't share our values. So for example, if the United Kingdom is going to have a government that arrests people for Facebook posts and then let hardened criminals out of prison early to make space for these people who've offended people on for social media posts, that's a as Elon Musk has referred to Keir Starmer as two-tier Keir, referring to the two-tier Keir of policing and justice. That's a bad look. Or when the Metropolitan Police Commissioner threatens to arrest U.S. citizens over social media posts. Again, that does have implications for a potential UK-US free trade agreement. And I think we'll be looking at the whole gamut of values and policies when we approach trade in this next administration.
Interesting. Let's talk China, because that's obviously the target for a lot of these trade actions and probably the easiest example to use when you're talking about the need for restructuring trade policy. I was in China when it joined the WTO, and you know, was very familiar with the attitude of American companies. Actually worked for US law firms there for a bit. How likely do you think it is that China's permanent normal trading relationship with the United States will be revoked?
Well, there's currently a bill that has been introduced in Congress. It's Congressman Mulaner's bill. He sits on the he's on the China Select Committee in the House of Representatives, and so they argue not just taking away PNTR, permanent normal trading relation status, but also, which used to be known as most favored nation status, but also de minimis. And of course, that would be that's something that I think that there is broad support for.
De minimis, I might just like to explain because people won't.
There's a we waive $800 worth of small shipments in the United States, or for example, American citizens can bring in the airport or when they cross the border can bring $800 worth of goods duty free. What we have a problem there because companies like Shein and Temu are sending these small shipments in, and Customs and Border Protection officials in the United States refer to de minimis with regards to China as the unofficial U.S.-China free trade agreement. So they're doing shipments just under $800, small shipments, and a lot of those shipments to try to get around paying the duties on those shipments. There's also another huge problem. In the 1990s, we stopped screening packages, irrespective of this, we stopped screening packages. And I think we need to actually beef up Customs and Border Protection and actually start, irrespective of tariffs and de minimis, we actually have to start going back to a system like they've done in the European Union, where now they actually screen everything. And so when you order a package from the United States, as I do when I go to Europe, and or the United Kingdom, for example, I actually order something from the United States, it'll come very quickly to the United Kingdom or to Western Europe, but then it sits in a processing center waiting to be screened for about a week to week and a half, and eventually then it's delivered to my house. So that's cumbersome. It does add along a lot of time in which you get your package from overseas. But when I talk to European Union officials in the trade sphere, they tell me that that's actually something necessary, not just to combat the illegal drug trade, but also terrorism, because they've been able to foil terrorist plots, et cetera. So there's a lot of things we need to start doing, because, of course, we have a fentanyl crisis here in the United States, an illegal drug trade with packages, small packages coming in. They're avoiding screening. And then, of course, we have generations of people being affected adversely by the epidemic of illegal drugs.
So just moving back to the question, which I pushed you off.
Sure.
Revoking PNTR status with China, do you think that's actually going to happen?
Well, it'll have to come. Well, there's that bill, but it's, that bill was introduced in this session of Congress. It'll have to be taken up again in the next session of Congress. And I don't have a crystal ball, but it's definitely going to be an issue. I would say this, though, when President Trump goes into his negotiations with President Xi of China, he'll want to have all sorts of things in his arsenal to negotiate with. So the only thing that I think is maybe, and I have no idea, because I don't know how the administration is going to approach the issue. They may want to have that as something that they can negotiate with before Congress would preemptively take that away. Also, if you look at the historical context of taking away PNTR, well, Russia and Belarus over the invasion of Ukraine, so a time of war, Cuba, North Korea, definitely, you know, the United States identifies China as a foreign adversary. But when you look at the historical context, when we've taken away PNTR, it's been done when something like an invasion happens. So you can definitely expect, if China were to invade Taiwan, there would definitely be a removal of PNTR, as there are other historical examples for that. Some might argue that if you remove PNTR, you know, too quickly, then what is the what would stop China from invading Taiwan? Because some might argue that China wouldn't invade Taiwan, because that would be such a shock to have PNTR removed from them. So again, it could be seen as a deterrent to China invading Taiwan.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, though, because of the additional tariffs that Trump's proposed, there's almost like a de facto revoking of PNTR, isn't there? Because it is all whether those tariffs continue and the type of tariffs that the executive can impose is sort of at the discretion of the president. And that was always the deal with permanent normal trading relations. You had to renew it. Congress had to renew it each year, and there would be an airing about human rights abuses and stuff in China, and that would sort of, they'd eventually get it through, but it was a good way of sort of checking in to see how things were going.
If I could just interject there. So with PNTR, we have the harmonized tariff schedule here in the United States. And so if you remove PNTR from a country, it means all their goods go in from schedule one to within the harmonized tariff schedule, it goes from column one to column two. So column one is you know, there's almost no tariffs, you know, and then of course you move into column two, and then depending on the product, you'd have to look at the columns in the tariff schedule to see which product applies to which tariff level. But you're looking at the increase of tariffs from column one to column two by 30, 40 to 50%. So that's quite a dramatic change. And that would be quite a shock to not just the Chinese economy, but also the United States economy. And if you go to some certain large box stores like Best Buy or Walmart or places like that, much of the products in the stores are from China, made in China. So again, you would want that phased in over time, so business could adapt. And also, a lot of people suggested that this should happen in concert with our allies, because if the United States unilaterally does these things, then what's just, you know, China will simply find other markets for their goods, and so they can recover from this. And of course, you know, then there's a whole other argument of will businesses swallow some of that tariff and try not to put the cost on the consumer. But I think it's safe to say there'll be a lot of cost put on the consumer, but it will be a China shock. So, but then again, I want to make very clear that we made a huge grave error in judgment. I'll finish with this. I mean, I remember when I was at university, I was told, you know, that China was the future. We were going to embrace them. We're going to allow them into WTO. I was at university when that was happening. And they said that this was going to, China was going to become just like us. They'd become a liberal democracy. And that has not happened. And that the Chinese Communist Party would fall away and they would liberalize. That has not happened. And so if we're going to remove PNTR or just decouple from China, as we should, we have to basically ask ourselves, are we willing to take some harsh economic medicine? Yes, we need to manage that carefully. But there will be, whenever you transition from one system to the other, the transition is very difficult. And there will be harsh decisions to make. And we will have to take some economic pain. And I think we need to be absolutely open about that as we go from this. Because it's not just an economic issue. It's a national security issue.
Yeah, I mean, look, I remember it very, very well, China's accession to the WTO and the PNTR debate in 2000 and before. And I think in retrospect, people, well, I almost guarantee Heritage at the time was probably arguing it was a good idea.
Yes, we did.
And we've changed our policy.
We've changed our policy. Yeah. We used to be religiously free trade, but as Ambassador Lighthizer and others have taught us, we should not have free trade with non-market economies, foreign adversaries, and autocracies like China. For example, it was a huge mistake to let China into the WTO, where they game the system. They self-identify as a developing country, which is downright absurd. At the IMF and also at the World Bank, there is a system where a country can graduate from being identified as a developing country. But not at the WTO. The WTO, China and other countries wrongly self-identify as a developing country and gain the system and get preferential treatment as a result. So we need to have reform of the system. I mean, there's just so many problems with regard to doing business in China. The mere fact that I think it's so wrong and just that American companies operating in China to abide by Chinese law have to have a Communist Party cell if they employ more than three Communist Party members, Chinese Communist Party members. Well, given that there are 126 million members of the Chinese Communist Party, we can expect that most medium-sized businesses operating in China have to have a Communist Party cell. That is a blurring of the lines of politics and government into private business. It's wrong. It's not free market. It's not free trade. And we shouldn't be trading with that country on that level. And we need to start calling that out. And then, of course, there's lots of other issues I could go into about human rights, forced labor, et cetera. I mean, this is just a brutal regime, and we've treated them as if they're some sort of, you know, fellow traveler with our system and our values, and they are not like us. Their system is not based upon the rule of law.
I have a lot of experience in this area. Moving back to on a different angle, Australia, right? We, unlike many other countries, have a current account deficit with the United States. We import more from you guys than we sell to you, unlike China. Our major exports are things like beef and lamb, wine, machinery, pharmaceuticals, aluminium and minerals and iron ore to some extent, although obviously we sell a lot more to China. So going forward, either with this 10 or 20% global universal tariff or the border adjustment tax, which you think might happen, how should Australia play that? Should we be seeking individual exemptions from that new tax regime, or should we just have to suck it up? Or
no,
for example, I was just having a chat with a girl who sells wine the other day, and she was saying in Australia, oh yeah, you know, they were quite worried about a 10 or 20% tax on Australian wine to the United States, because that would have a real and significant impact on our exports there. And a lot of in Australia, I think the establishment here to a large extent has been in denial. They didn't expect the Trump win. I mean, who to come back? Who did?
I never questioned it.
Yeah. Well, I was in your boat too, but I were a select few. But they haven't thought through exactly what they should be doing. They're sort of putting their hands in their ears and going, la, la, la. Well, how should Australia play this?
Well, so for example, we have a free trade agreement with Australia. So for starters, and I think I've already tried to explain the difficulties, the feasibility, the legal issues at the executive level, trying to do an across the board tariff of 10 or 20%. Mm. Then, of course, with the border adjustment tax, I really don't see that as a threat to Australia because I think 5 to 7% is reasonable in the absence of the United States having a VAT as you already have in Australia. So we're simply correcting our tax system, and that's a tariff-like tax as you have a VAT already as well, and we don't have one at the federal level. So I don't, and that's something that may or may not come in a tax bill next year when, of course, some of the Trump taxes come up for renewal. Tax cuts come up for renewal. So that's something that could be added at the end. And I don't have a crystal ball and I don't know if that's actually going to happen, but we have made the case for that. And I don't think that's a threat to the Australian economy. I think what is a bigger threat, and I've never heard this coming from anyone, the executive, I hear this coming from really groups that are quite, I would say, outliers in the trade policy voice, certainly in Congress. I'll give you an example. I received a call last year in 2023, I think it was in September. My former intern actually worked for a senator who will remain nameless and said, hey, my boss just got a copy of the RCAF petition. Should he sign on to this? And I'm like, well, let's talk about that. Why? He says, first of all, send me the copy of the petition because I hadn't seen it yet. And basically, it was calling for tariffs on Australian and New Zealand lamb. And it was saying that Australia had, you know, poor environmental policies and all that sort of stuff. And it was really missing the point. There does seem to be some people think that a tariff is a panacea for all of our problems. But then if you look at some of the roots of the problem, it has nothing to do with foreign countries and trade. What it has to do is bad policymaking here in Washington, often by civil servants. So at the Environmental Protection Agency, our sheep farmers are at a huge disadvantage compared to Australian ones and New Zealand ones because they cannot strategically place poison bait around their farms. So, but you can in Australia. And then in New Zealand, they don't have predators. But here in the United States, we seem to have a policy that prioritizes the welfare of coyotes and foxes instead of sheep. And so what's happened is some American sheep farmers have lost 40% of their herds due to predators. So that's a problem that we created here in Washington that was not created in Australia or New Zealand. And we need to address that here. And that's what I basically communicated in response. And I published an op-ed in The Hill, which is a publication read by senators and congressmen and their staff, basically arguing the case against the RCAP petition because we created these bad policies here in Washington. And then, of course, the EPA comes up with an equally non-solution, another bad policy, telling these sheep farmers that they should invest in very expensive collars to put around their sheep with poison patches on them. And somehow, miraculously, these coyotes are going to go and bite into the poison patch and die, and then the sheep will be, you know, liberated. Well, that hasn't happened. What's happened is you're left with an expensive collar and poison patch that didn't work, and a dead carcass of a sheep. Also, because of inflation, we created here in Washington through printing money and purchasing our own debt, the monetizing of the debt, and overspending, basically farm feed last year was up by 15%. And so that, again, wipes out the profit margin. So we need to get a handle on the inflation here in Washington and not blame other countries for our problems. And so, again, I didn't hear that push coming from the executive. And I did hear that from groups like Coalition for a Prosperous America was promoting the RCAF petition. But it was largely, there were very, from the last I checked, very few congressmen and senators signed on to it. And I basically made a very robust case that the problems for our sheep industry were elsewhere, created here in the United States. So again, and I would also finish with this, at a time when we actually want to actually have Australia purchase our nuclear-powered submarines under the AUKUS agreement, why would we start tariffing their stuff? Again, I just don't see Australia on the radar screen of the administration. I know that my advice to New Zealand, when I New Zealand government, when I meet them, is try to get a a free trade agreement now. It certainly was something you could have done years ago under better weather, but it's now maybe be the time. But I really think that the focus of the targeted use of tariffs are going to be unfair practices. And as long as we identify what those unfair practices are and who the usual suspects are, you're primarily looking at countries like China. You're not looking at Australia, New Zealand.
What do you think Australia's trade policy should be going forward? Should we be adopting tariffs either globally or selectively against China? For example, under the free trade agreement that we negotiated with China, essentially close to 100% of Chinese manufactured goods can come into Australia duty-free. Is that a policy which should continue in your view?
No, I think you should. I don't think Australia should have a free trade agreement with China. I think that you need to decouple and de-risk, as the United States is attempting to do. And I think that we need to have a coalition of the free, of countries that, you know, we find trading partners that are free market economies that share our values, and not, you know, basically, you know, not trade with foreign, not have free trade with foreign adversaries. And I know that for years, just like the United States, successive Australian administrations have promoted and said that your future was in Asia. That's fine, but also said your future was with China. I don't agree. I think there are other countries in Asia that we could be having free trade with, like, for example, India. I'd like the United States to source its intermediate goods from countries like India. And there's some great trade preference programs that enable that in the United States. So, for example, if you look at the generalized system of preference, that's a preference program for developing countries that has been was not renewed in 2020. And just a couple months ago, the Democrats have held up in Congress that process. In fact, some bills that they introduced talked about implementing, making obligations for ESG and DEI for the renewal of GSP, the generalized system of preference. Now, that's just, so the left has basically held it up because of those sorts of reasons, which would make the program heavily expensive and unworkable for the countries you want to partake in the program. For example, the green stuff would make developing countries more unlikely to take it up because it's so expensive. And then something like gender parity in India would be culturally difficult. Referring to some of the DEI obligations that have been suggested by Democrats. But then if you look at some of the protectionists saying, oh, well, you know, we need to get rid of GSP because we want to source all those goods in the United States. Well, we're not going to source them in the United States. Americans want to have high-tech jobs. They don't want to work in factories making rope, which we can buy for India or Africa. We would just automate a factory like that. Anyway, we wouldn't be creating a factory for workers. We also don't have the workers to take on those sorts of jobs. We'd have to import lots of new migrants. So since 2020, since we have not renewed the GSP program for developing countries to source cheap intermediate goods, well, we're now getting those goods from China. So it actually increased because we just operate with China under the WTO rules as they've got PNTR under column one of the harmonized tariff schedule. So all that trade just largely shifted to China, increased the trade deficit, and we lost markets in Africa, for example, to China. And of course, next year, the AGOA program for Sub-Saharan Africa, that trade preference program, will be up for renewal, as well as the Haiti program. So we need to renew those trade preference programs for developing countries and our allies in those countries so we can source good quality intermediate goods from countries that are not foreign adversaries like China. So that's a solution. But again, some of the more ideological protectionists, certainly more the outliers, they're suggesting that, no, this is a bad thing. It'll actually take away America's jobs, or that's not true. It's actually businesses have stopped trading and sourcing intermediate goods, or they're just getting them from China. So the data all shows that since we have renewed GSP, it's increased the trade deficit with China. So I think there's a way to have trade preference programs with our allies and friends to source intermediate goods so we can make high-end manufactured goods.
Yeah. Our trade agreement with China was actually signed on the very day that Trump came down the escalators in New York, so in 2015.
Right. So ironic. I don't think any
member of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade here would have possibly imagined the upheaval to thinking on trade that he would have brought. How has your thinking on trade changed since 2015? And I'm not just talking about China in particular, because in some ways that's an easy case to make, but more generally, I mean, is there a broader case to be made that it's, while it may not make sense in a purist economic, you know, world, theory world, there are other harmful effects, social effects, which impact on people in, you know, Ohio, where the J.D. Vance is from, which weren't properly factored in over the years when discussing shipping goods offshore to parts of the world and importing them back in duty-free?
I would agree. Since 2015, well, I was working in the United Kingdom. It was 2017. 2015, I was actually working here. No, I actually have to say that I came early on to the position. I've always been for free trade, but again, for like-minded allies, free market economies. I've always been concerned about China. And I think that came because before I worked on trade policy, I was actually working for a Democrat member of Congress on human rights issues and was very aware of how China, it's horrendous what happens there. And indeed, I actually entertained here at the Heritage Foundation, the vice president for government relations of the Xi'an Corporation, where he explained to me, he said, oh, last year we had 20%, our independent auditors told us we had 20% Uyghur slave labor in our supply chains. And this year it's down to 8%. And I said, well, that's 8% too much. And I can't imagine American, you know, business executive trying to explain as a positive, lowering your forced labor in your supply chain down, or slave labor, let's just call it what is Uyghur slave labor, down to 8%. How is that a win? How is that a positive? So again, I've always been aware of the human rights aspect. So I was always quite, you know, suspect of the argument that they were going to become just like us, and that they were going to liberalize and the CCP would fall away. I've been aware of the difficulties with China. Having said that, when I went to work at the UK's Department for International Trade in 2017, and of course, everyone was really excited. Some people were excited that we were leaving the European Union. They're saying, well, the future's with China. And it's, a lot of people were saying that. And I felt that that was very naive. I was actually encouraged to encourage British investors to invest in China's Belt and Road program, which I thought was wrong because of I saw the geostrategic implications of the Belt and Road, whereas a lot of my colleagues just saw pound signs and dollar signs. I think we need to have an ethical trade approach.
Outside of having reservations with trading with countries with poor human rights records, more generally on trade, has your thinking at all changed? Because, you know, Trump has been, he's referenced people like William McKinley and Abraham Lincoln who were in favor of high tariff walls in the United States. His criticism is focused on China, but it's not only China when it comes to trade.
Well, right? Yes, he has referenced McKinley, but if you look at Abraham Lincoln, or certainly McKinley, the federal government was a fraction of the size it is now. And I think you also just have to look at the people that President Trump has appointed into his administration. And I've noticed some of the, if you look at for groups like the Coalition for Prosperous America and some of the other protectionist groups, I haven't noticed them celebrating some of the appointments, like Scott Bessent to the Treasury. So I think, and of course, if you look also at the appointment of former Senator Perdue to the China Special Envoy position, this is a man who used to lived in Asia, lived in Hong Kong. He was a businessman operating in Asia, and I think that the press release that was out there was more nuanced and less hawkish than it could be. So again, I think that President Trump has a lot of things he's going to try to achieve in his second term. He'll have 4 years. I think he's going to be very realistic, and I think that he's got to get a handle on the system here at home. He was treated incredibly badly by the deep state. The lawfare was unacceptable against him. These politically motivated lawsuits. And what a former president has suffered that. The way that the Biden administration weaponized the Department of Justice against him and other Americans was unacceptable. The spying on Americans. I think that free speech, censorship are going to become huge issues. And I think addressing the problems with the civil service and a government that he discovered in his first term, a permanent state that really opposed him and tried to push back against what he was trying to implement. He's had 4 years out of office to think long and hard how he's going to do that. If you look at the appointments that he's made, Kash Patel and others, or with if you look at, for example, Doge,
yeah,
exactly, and Elon Musk, I think that you're going to look a total reworking of the system. And some of it's not unreasonable. Mm-hmm. I was recently interviewed a few months ago by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And I had the journalist say to me, "How dare you're going to take away the U.S. federal government's Department of Education?" And I responded to this Canadian journalist, "You don't have a federal Department of Education in Canada. You've got provincial ministries of education at the provincial level. So we, like Canada, don't want to have overlap and duplication and what have you." So I think that there's going to be a lot of reforms made that aren't going to actually be so different from what some other countries do with regards to dealing with bigger government, overlap, duplication, and a politicized permanent civil service that needs to be brought back into control. Their job should not be under the Hatch Act. They're not supposed to be political. They're not supposed to take on political positions and try to obstruct policies that come from the democratically elected executive. So I think he's going to have a lot of things he's going to try to do at the domestic level as well. And I think a lot of the things that have happened over the last 4 years under President Biden, like the disastrous withdrawal of Afghanistan, the Hamas invasion of Israel, and what we've seen, I just don't think we're going to see the turmoil internationally, the invasion of Ukraine. I don't think that would have happened if President Trump had been in office. If you look under USMCA, I saw the way President AMLO of Mexico took advantage of he saw what he could get away with under President Biden by violating USMCA, the new NAFTA, and getting rid of the regulatory bodies, getting rid of their appointed judges for elected judges, and the Biden administration not doing enough to combat that. And I think there's going to be there's a new sheriff in town, and he's going to take a very different approach. And I just don't see picking a fight with Australia and New Zealand, two close allies, as high on his agenda. I think it's relatively goodness and light with us at the moment. And I think that there's going to be some issues he's going to address quite quickly. And of course, the issue of border control, the fentanyl crisis, even before he takes office, he's used the threat of tariffs to address those. And it worked. I mean, Trudeau got on a plane and went right down and had dinner with Howard Lutnick on one side and Trump on the other, and acquiesced. So again, he will use tariffs, but like I said, I just don't see an area where that's going to be an issue with Australia. I don't think that's high on the priority.
There might be there'll be some wrinkles like there were last time, but I think in Trump's view, because we are current accounts, the US has a current account surplus with us, unlike other places, you know, where we're in the good books, at least as long as we don't impose any sort of crazy internet stuff which ticks off Elon. I think that's my take on it all.
Well, I was concerned about the misinformation bill.
Yeah, it may not have completely died yet, too, by the way. I really appreciate you making time, Andrew. There's going to be a lot of movement going forward. There's a new sheriff in town, but there's also a broad-based team to me that seem a lot more sort of steeled in fire because of the battles that they've had over the last 4 years, and with a lot more resolve to get the particular things done. And I'm sure Heritage will be at the center of that all. So if people want to find out more about you and your work, what's the best way that they can look you up?
Yeah, so I have a Twitter handle, Drew Hale DC, or you can find me, Andrew Hale, on the Heritage Foundation website. We'll also find some of my published works on a lot of the issues we've been talking about. Indeed, particularly about China, my colleague Donna Furchgott-Roth and we published a couple months ago a Chinese handcuff paper. We addressed some trade issues, as well as energy policy and the environment. And so there's a lot of stuff I think that your viewers can find useful there on our website.
Great stuff. Well, I really appreciate your time. I look forward to
thank you.
Keeping in touch as the days go ahead. And it's good to have someone who has, you know, familiarity with UK, US, and also Australian trade issues to touch base with. So appreciate your time. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. Have a nice evening. Bye-bye.